Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Memcast. You're lucky because this week myself and my guest have both just finished some long on-call shifts, but despite my dysarthria and obvious facial droop, I've actually not suffered a stroke. On-calls are just one of the many stroke mimics we're going to be talking about this week. And we have Dr. Dimple Shah, a stroke and elderly care medicine registrar from Northampton General Hospital, here to join us today. Hi, thank you very much for coming on, Dimple.
Hello.
Dimple made my weekend a lot easier by clerking everyone by the time my shift started. So that was excellent. Thank you for that.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
So this week we do have an episode on stroke mimics. We're going to be covering what a stroke mimic is, what kind of conditions actually count as a stroke mimic, what might come in as a thrombolysis call that look like a stroke but actually aren't. We're going to look at how those conditions differ from a stroke, how you might identify those differences. And then we're going to talk about the investigations and things that might help us make those decisions, those things that we can do quickly that might help us tease out whether something is or is not a stroke. Just something quick to mention is we're not covering posterior circulation strokes in this episode because there's a huge amount to talk about there, and that might be something we look at in an episode in the future. So, Dimple, one of the first things I want to ask you is, what is a stroke mimic? How is it different from a stroke?
So I thought, before going into what a stroke mimic is, just a very quick recap on what's a stroke. So if we go for the formal World Health Organization definition, it's quite a mouthful. So they describe it as a rapidly developing clinical signs of focal or global disturbance of cerebral function, lasting more than 24 hours or leading to death, with no apparent cause other than vascular origin. That's a little bit too complicated to remember. So just to put it simply, a stroke is a rapid loss of brain function due to the disturbance in the blood flow to the brain. So what is a stroke mimic? A stroke mimic is just a popular term used to distinguish patients presenting often acutely with stroke-like symptoms, but it turns out they have an alternative diagnosis. So just to put it simply, it's someone who presents like they may have had a stroke, but actually the diagnosis is something completely different.
Perfect. And obviously as somebody that then comes to stroke calls, the worrying thing is you've got someone in front of you who looks like they've had a stroke, you've got a very short amount of time to make a decision on whether they have had a stroke, but you're worried about thrombolizing someone who then hasn't had a stroke. So I guess part of this episode will be how do we help people? What kind of advice can we give people so that they feel confident in making their decisions?
Yes, I think it is interesting to talk about stroke mimics in the context of thrombolysis. In an acute stroke, every minute, 1.9 million neurons are lost. So in order to save brain, you do have to act very, very fast. So when you do attend these thrombolysis calls, you'll see that there's a lot of pressure to work quickly, assess quickly, and get that door-to-needle time down as much as possible. And by needle, we mean the time taken to start the thrombolysis agent.
Having done some thrombolysis calls and things myself, it can often be very, very difficult. And you sometimes are never going to be able to completely exclude one of the mimics we're going to be able to talk about. And oftentimes you'll be thrombolizing a patient, at the back of your mind you're going, maybe this is a mimic, but there's not a real good way for me to rule that out in time. Is that something that happens quite frequently? Is that something I should be worried about, potentially thrombolizing these mimics?
I would say definitely don't worry too much about it. And it does happen. I myself, in previous thrombolysis calls, on reflection, have definitely thrombolized mimics. And we'll talk about some of those mimics a little bit later. But actually looking at data, so SNAP audit, so SNAP stands for the Sentinel Stroke National Audit Program, is a national healthcare quality improvement program. And each trust who are involved in thrombolysis calls have to submit data to this national program. And the aim is to analyse the information and feed it back to everyone across the UK. So it's a UK-wide audit, just to give us a bit of information on who we're thrombolysing and what outcomes are and what's actually happening in these calls. So in the SNAP audit in 2021, it identified that the proportion of stroke mimics receiving thrombolysis between different sites across the UK ranged anywhere from 0% to up to 10.7%. And roughly 1 in 13 thrombolysed patients were actually a mimic. Also it found, which I found quite interesting, is the mimics were typically in younger patients of average age about 58, whereas the stroke patients that we were thrombolizing were more about 74 years old. Of note, there was no data collected about the complications following thrombolizing a patient who didn't have a stroke and who actually had a mimic. But when you speak to a lot of stroke consultants and from their kind of anecdotal experience, it's found that the complication rate is a lot lower compared to thrombolizing a stroke patient. And that might just be down to simple things such as there's no damaged brain tissue. So the likelihood of like a hemorrhagic transformation or other complications is a lot lower in a mimic, which is one of the biggest things we worry about at registrars is what if the patient has a hemorrhagic transformation or a large bleed that can be fatal. But it's felt that these complications are a lot lower in stroke mimics compared to thrombolizing a stroke. So I hope that puts some minds at ease about being a bit fearful about thrombolizing a stroke mimic.
Yeah, I think obviously we're going to talk a lot about the different kinds of things we need to look out for, but thrombolysis calls aren't an exact science, and there's always going to be an element of using the information available to you at the time and the best judgment you can. And I think it is reassuring to know that actually this isn't perfect. It's not like you're going to be able to get it right every time, but if you're as informed as possible and we go through as many of those mimics as we can, it'll give you the best shot of identifying the right patients to thrombolize and the patients that maybe you wouldn't be looking at thrombolizing. Dimple, what are your top stroke mimics to look out for when you're on a thrombolysis call?
Someone on a course I recently went on, a UK acute stroke simulation course, they summarised it in a really nice way of thinking of stroke mimics as the S's. So just to kind of briefly go through the S's, it's things like seizures, it could be sugars, so hyperglycemia or other metabolic imbalances that cause stroke-like symptoms. It can be sepsis or syncope. It can be severe headaches such as migraines, space-occupying lesions or subdurals. Actually, the list for stroke mimics is very, very long. But the more you practice it, the more you realise some of them are slightly more common than others. And maybe we'll go through some of the more common ones.
You've mentioned seizures as a common stroke mimic. Now, I often find the problem I have sometimes had with seizures myself is it can be a bit chicken and egg. So has this person had a stroke, had a seizure as a result of damage to the brain, and then that I need to treat that? Or is this a patient who has had a seizure and is now got like a Todd's paresis or is post-ictal? So I find that really challenging. Do you have any sort of advice about how to tease out those seizures that are as a result of a stroke, those seizures that are just seizures presenting with weakness afterwards?
Yeah, so it, like you said, it's difficult. I think history and trying to establish a timeline is what's most important in these cases. Typically, strokes present with negative symptoms rather than positive symptoms. And what we mean by negative is they present with a neurological deficit. So a seizure would be considered a positive symptom. But like you touched on, it's not impossible for someone who's had or having a seizure to have had a stroke as well. For instance, hemorrhagic strokes can very typically lead to a seizure as well. And that's when if you try and establish a timeline of did they present with the weakness and the visual disturbance and the speech disturbance first and then have a seizure would kind of help paint the picture a little bit better. Imaging will obviously help if it's a hemorrhagic stroke. You'll clearly see it on a CT imaging. But when you're doing the initial stages of just assessing the patient and taking the history, establishing the timeline is really, really important. You touched on Todd's paresis, and I think that's one that we worry about all the time is this Todd's paresis versus is this a stroke? So I thought it'd be important just to talk a little bit about what is Todd's paresis. So Todd's paresis is a paralytic state, and it remains after an epileptic convulsion, so after a seizure. These are particularly seen when these convulsions only affect one side of the body, and it can last for hours and even days, but eventually you will get a full recovery. The full neurological deficit will resolve, which you know is slightly different to strokes where you could be left with the deficit lifelong.
Well, it's interesting that you've talked about the timeline, and I think that's something that has been mentioned to me multiple times, is that actually getting a very clear history of when things started, how they started, and the order of things happening gives you a clue. If someone's got a background of epilepsy, had a seizure, and now is weak, that's very different from I was on the phone with my dad, their voice started becoming slurred, and he said he couldn't move one side of his body, and then when the paramedics got there he was having a seizure. Like that's a very different story.
And following a major seizure you may see people in a post-ictal phase, which again you wouldn't necessarily see in stroke patients. And I think the take-home message is if it's a first presentation of a seizure with hemiparesis, you do need to do an urgent CT head. And if they've got lack of cortical symptoms, by which I mean no visual field defect, no gaze palsies, no neglect or inattention, no aphasia, that all supports more a Todd's paresis versus a stroke.
Yeah, this is it. Like you say, the more things you're picking up, the more lateralizing symptoms you're picking up, the more likely you think actually this is going to be a stroke. It's interesting that you've said about doing a CT head in someone's first presentation of a seizure, because that's a bit of a segue into one of the other stroke mimics, is that one of the things that can actually cause a seizure and mimic a stroke is space-occupying lesions as well, which you would pick up on that. So how might that present differently to a stroke?
So when thinking about space-occupying lesions, you'll notice this throughout this, the theme is the time taken for the symptoms to develop. So strokes are very acute, they're very sudden onset, completely well, healthy, living their life, speaking normally, doing everything normally, and the next second you've got new symptoms. So typically in a space-occupying lesion, they'll have more progressive neurology, maybe days and weeks or months of feeling unwell, having vague symptoms, and then they could have maybe more of an acute presentation due to either edema leading to seizures or a hemorrhagic transformation within the lesion. So they would have an acute element of their presentation, but the history will show that there's been actually a gradual rumbling in the background, which has led to today. Whereas in a stroke, it would be very much very, very well until you're not well and you've got symptoms.
I think there's a recurring theme in these, which I've talked to two people about this a few times, is that when you're at med school, everyone tells you how important the history is. You start working and you're like, oh, I've got all these tests, it's going to be fine, never need to talk to anyone ever again. And then the longer you work, you're like, actually, what I need is a good history, and that will help me tease out exactly what's going on.
Absolutely. Although the CT imaging and the MRI and everything will help with all of these cases, when you're in that first 10 minutes of what do I need to do, probably not even 10 minutes, when you're in the first 5 minutes of deciding what's going on, the establishing a proper history is key to all of these cases.
One of the most common mimics I've come across, the way it presents is often a patient coming from a care home, a bit of facial droop on the background of not being right the day before, and then somebody's come in and they're slumped in a chair and maybe they've got a bit of a temperature, or maybe they haven't, and they've come in as a thrombolysis call. And I think you mentioned in your essays as well that sepsis was one of those common mimics.
Absolutely. So you're right, sepsis is the way to think about it, is why is this septic patient presenting with this neurology? And it's all to do with perfusion. So the fact that they've probably got a blood pressure in the boots of about 70 systolic will lead to hyperperfusion globally, and including your brain. So if you're getting a reduced blood flow to the brain in a patient who's already either had a previous stroke or is more susceptible, such as your elderly patients, they are going to present with neurological deficits. So in patients who've had a previous stroke and with hyperperfusion to their brain, you can get decompensation of previous stroke symptoms, which are now presenting. Or even if they've not had a previous stroke in a, let's say, an elderly patient with dementia, you know that they've got a degree of either brain atrophy or vascular damage there that may have not presented previously as a stroke. You might see that now they're developing a facial droop or even some limb weakness, but it's not due to an acute stroke presentation, but it's more due to an underlying infective process or any other process that's leading to them being septic. But how do we differentiate that in clinical practice? I guess the key thing. So like we've said throughout this episode, history. History is key. Have they had infective symptoms leading up to today? Have they had that fever, the cough, the green productive cough? Have they been around others who have been unwell with infection symptoms? That would help. But also looking at them clinically now, a septic patient will look different to a stroke patient from the end of the bed. You know, they will have the fever, they'll be tachycardic, they'll may have raised lactate on their blood gas, or the blood through show a marked raised white cell count or CRP, all of which you wouldn't expect in an acute stroke presentation. Because like we said, typically stroke patients are well until the acute presentation. So you wouldn't necessarily have the other biochemical markers of an underlying infection.
One of the things that I occasionally use as well, and obviously you're never going to rely on one particular measure, but factoring in with everything else, whenever you've got someone that's had a stroke, they tend to have quite a high blood pressure. That can often be a problem when you're thrombolyzing them. And as you said, with these patients that are hypoperfusing, you're far more likely to see a low blood pressure. So sometimes that I found might point me in the direction of this being a mimic, along with a lot of all those other features in the history that you've mentioned.
Absolutely. I think blood pressure is a really key thing to look at. And you'll see that in one of the other S's, which is syncope.
It's interesting that you mentioned about the blood pressure and saying that that is linked to one of the other causes or the other stroke mimics that we deal with, which is syncope. So I guess the question that is important to ask is syncope usually a presenting feature of strokes?
Yes, we often see patients following syncope who present as a stroke, but it's really important to remember that strokes don't typically present with syncope. And the reason patients might have some neurological symptoms following a syncopal attack is all to do with poor perfusion to the brain, similar to sepsis. Importantly, the symptoms following syncope resolve as soon as the blood pressure normalizes, which is why you wouldn't typically see these patients in a thrombolysis call, but you might see them in a TIA clinic. However, it's really important to remember the cause of the syncope should be thoroughly investigated. It could be something as simple as postural hypertension, but there are 101 other causes, for instance, cardiac syncope, so they should be investigated a little bit further.
So the key, like you said there, is that blood pressure comes back up, symptoms go away, as perfusion is restored, and all is well in the brain.
Exactly.
Wonderful. So we've got, so far we've had sepsis, space-occupying lesions, we've had syncope, we've talked about seizures as well. There's a couple of other things you mentioned in your S's, and one of them wasn't really an S. So you mentioned to me before we're calling it severe headaches.
But, severe headaches.
Can you tell me a little bit about migraines?
But that's what I mean. Severe headaches, according to migraines. So hemiplegic migraines is a subtype of migraine with aura. Migraine with aura, or hemiplegic migraines, will present in typically younger patients, typically female patients, with that stroke-like symptoms of weakness on one side of their body, which gets called through as a thrombolysis stroke patient, which is understandable. But important things to remember is migraine with auras are usually a recurrent condition. They often have other symptoms that are not typically related to strokes. For instance, they'll have the visual auras of flashing lights or halos around objects. And they have more visual, speech, sensory symptoms before they have motor symptoms. Also, hemiplegic migraines typically have a familial component, so it's really important to ask about any family history. And they would be seen in patients who don't really have any other stroke risk factors. So they may be non-smokers, they might be quite young, female, healthy patients, which you wouldn't expect to have a stroke.
It's interesting that you've mentioned they tend to be recurrent symptoms, because that was my experience of this as well, is that not always, but often it wasn't their first thrombolysis call, and they could tell you it was always their left arm, and it was, you know, always that side of the face. And I'd always say, well, it would be very unlikely that you'd be throwing a clot into the very same spot of your brain over and over again, with it disappearing. So that was always quite reassuring. Earlier, you mentioned positive and negative symptoms in reference to seizures specifically. Is that something that is helpful in these migraine patients as well?
Absolutely, yes. So thinking of the positive symptoms of the flashing lights, typically also they could get a numbness, pins and needle sensation in the body, which you wouldn't always see with strokes. So it's good to always have those positive and negative symptoms in the back of your mind when approaching these patients. Another thing to just remember is, you're right, we do often see these patients as recurrent presentations with the same presentations, with or without the headache. The headache doesn't always have to be present, although I'm putting under S for severe headache. The severe headache doesn't necessarily have to be there. But if it's their first presentation with hemiplegia and you're still thinking migraine with aura, guidelines do suggest doing an MRI scan if it's their first presentation to exclude anything else, because young people can have strokes. I don't want you to come away from this thinking, oh, it's a young patient, and it doesn't mean that makes it less likely. Yes, it makes it less likely, but not impossible. So if it's their first ever presentation with hemiplegia, having an MRI is important just to rule out any other underlying pathology.
Yeah, I think it's important to say that with all of these things, what we're trying to do is give a framework for deciding a pretest probability, if you like, the patients that are likely to have had a stroke and the patients that are less likely to have a stroke. And as we said at the start, it's not an exact science, which is what makes this so difficult. Now, there will be cases where it's the sixth time someone's come in with pins and needles in their left arm, and actually you look back on the system and they've had three MRIs this year. Those patients is possibly more reassuring. But if someone comes in with weak left arm and tingling on the left side of their face in their 30s, and it's never ever happened to them before, that's a different patient. And like you said, we do still need to be taking those patients seriously, because there are causes of young stroke as well. But that's another podcast in itself. So we've gone through quite a few different mimics, but one thing you mentioned actually at the start of the podcast was metabolic causes like low blood sugar. Is that something you see potentially on your thrombolysis course when you go to see patients?
Yes, absolutely. Another S for sugar. Sugar and other electrolyte abnormalities are very, very common. I myself, in my previous experience, have seen a patient with hypokalemia, and she came in with a potassium of 2.5 with some right arm weakness. And she was treated as a stroke initially. However, her potassium continued to drop. She developed more neurological symptoms affecting both sides of her body. She became more evident that that was actually a stroke mimic, and the low potassium was inducing a paralysis. As her potassium was corrected, her symptoms resolved as well. So it's very similar with low blood sugars. It's a very quick and simple thing to test. I mean, never forget glucose. Always check it when any patient coming in, whether you're thinking stroke or not, and doesn't necessarily have to be a diabetic patient. Always check blood sugars.
Excellent advice. And the potassium patient's very, very interesting as well. So we've talked through quite a few different of the different types of common stroke mimics. I just wanted to touch briefly on subdurals and epidurals very quickly, because that's another, I guess, bleed that technically isn't a hemorrhagic stroke that sometimes comes in as a thrombolysis call, and obviously something you don't want to miss if the thing you're thinking of doing is thrombolysing somebody.
Absolutely.
How do subdurals tend to present?
So subdurals can actually present very similar to strokes in like all the mimics do. They might have that one-sided neurological deficit. And I think a lot of people refer subdurals to stroke team thinking, well, it's a bleed in the brain. Why is it not considered under stroke? But that goes back to thinking about the pathophysiology of stroke is the lack of blood supply causing an ischemic damage to the brain. So even in a hemorrhagic stroke, the bleed has led to part of the brain tissue being starved of oxygen and leading to ultimately ischemic damage. In a subdural, the reason the patients have symptoms is more to do with the mass effect of the blood occupying that space. Also, typically, subdurals present with a progressive neurological deficit rather than an acute, although it can be acute, unfortunately, like all of these, it still can be acute. And they may have a history of a head injury, which could be on the day of presentation, but it could be, especially in elderly patients, several days or weeks before. Because if you think about it, the origin of a subdural bleed is a venous bleed. So they're more likely to be a slow trickling bleed, whereas a acute hemorrhagic stroke is an arterial bleed, which is a lot more high pressure, fast developing symptoms. And talking about pressure, in a hemorrhagic stroke, you'd expect blood pressure to be very, very high, typically above 200 systolic, whereas in a subdural, you wouldn't necessarily get that alteration in blood pressure or hypertension, which clinically would point you more towards subdural rather than an acute hemorrhagic stroke. However, ultimately, these patients all need an urgent CT head and maybe even neurosurgical intervention, so we should be CTing them as soon as possible.
We've gone through, I think, there some of the most common mimics, and as we've said before, there's actually a huge number of different things that can mimic a stroke, things that we haven't got around to talking about. Is there anything that you would like people to really take away from this? Any key take-home points about stroke mimics for, I don't know, IMTs that might be doing their stroke placement or regs that are going to like their first sets of thrombolysis calls and are worried about mimics? What should people keep in their head when they go to these calls?
I think, don't be worried. Around 50% of the cases you'll see on a thrombolysis call will be a mimic. And inevitably, the more you thrombolyze, the more likely you are to thrombolyze a mimic, and that's still okay. If we're doing assessments appropriately and correctly, and we've got the negative CT heads and they fit in the window, it's fully appropriate to thrombolyze. And B, strokes is a very senior-led specialty. You're never going to be on your own. It's a consultant-led decision, and all our job is, as the registrars or the IMTs, is just to do a really thorough assessment and do a really thorough history. And also with strokes, always think a little bit outside the box. For instance, I've previously seen a gentleman who was doing a shopping, came out of a taxi, fell and had dense right leg weakness. And understandably, he got brought to the hospital as a possible stroke. But when you take a step back, you look at him and you do a proper examination, he's in severe pain in his right side of his hip. And it turns out he's actually got a right-sided neck of femur fracture and not a stroke. So always take a step back. Although you're working in a high-pressure, fast-paced environment, try and slow down your thought process and really paint a clear picture of what you think is going on. But always remember, you're supported, so don't worry.
And also, Dimple will tell you she'd rather do 20 thrombolysis calls than one more podcast. So it's clearly, you know, that this is way more anxiety-inducing than your thrombolysis.
100%. Most nerve-wracking thing I've ever done. Thrombolysis calls are way easier. Honestly, it's fine.
Oh, brilliant. Well, The last thing for me to say is just have a look at the MCQs on Instagram this week. Make sure to follow the podcast, and we'll have another episode out next Friday as well. And thank you very much, Dimple, for coming on and talking to us.
Thank you, Tom.